This is VOA 1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and phrases with English learners in mind. Today is September 27th, 2020. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. Then Brian Lin gives us a technology story about fewer Europeans using coronavirus tracing apps. I will be back with words in their stories. Today, I talk about running. And we end our program with the making of a nation. But first, here is Dr. Jill.
International students accepted to the Parsons School of Design in New York City usually move to the city and learn about American culture outside of the classroom. They experience the sights, sounds, and eateries of New York and have a chance to meet other people who live and work there. Now these international students are back at home with their families. Their classes are offered online and sometimes taught in the middle of the night while everyone around them is sleeping. Nicole Becerra is a 17-year-old from Peru. She moved to New York to study English a year ago so that she could attend the Parsons School of Design. Parsons is one of the 5 colleges at the new school. Becerra says that, like many first-year students, she gained weight during her first few months in New York. One reason may be that she was eating the wonderful mix of foods that the city offers. She returned home at the end of 2019 and was there when the coronavirus pandemic struck. Since then, she has only taken online classes. Becerra added that she feels like she is in high school again, living at home and sleeping in her own room. She is not only studying English, but has time to study subjects she simply has an interest in, like French. She adds that her family is thankful she is with them during the pandemic. Gloria Chen is another Parsons student who is now in Taiwan. She was forced to change her sleep cycle, so she is now awake all night, taking classes at 2 in the morning on some days. Chen told VOA her family asks her to keep her voice low in the middle of the night, but she wants to speak louder.
It does bother them, and they will say, can you keep your volume a little bit lower? And I will say, yeah, I'll try it, but in the online classes, you're not sure.
Aretha Wong is a mathematics major at Ohio State University. She was living in Ohio when the school closed in March. Now, she is back home in China and taking online classes. She feels that it is harder to do the group work on the internet. Wong says students find it difficult to carry on a discussion in online breakout rooms. Gloria Chen says one good thing about online education is that all the classes are recorded. She says this helps her when she is studying for an exam.
In fact, I think the best thing about online classes is that the whole class will be recorded, and which gives me a lot of time to review and understand some point I don't understand at the time.
Several of the students I spoke with said they do not miss New York City's traffic. Becerra says she enjoys not spending time on getting to and from school.
I don't waste time in public transportation. I don't have to be in the snow waiting for my train.
And special clothing for the changing seasons is no longer a concern, said Chen. For many teachers, The long hours spent at a computer are more tiring than in-person classes. Elizabeth Marner Brooks teaches English to Parsons International students. She told VOA she had several health problems that were caused by sitting for most of the day. Students have asked for her help in forming discussion groups so they can get more experience speaking English. One student formed a WhatsApp group and noted every member of the group is in a different country. I'm Jill Robbins.
Thanks, Jill. And now, here is Brian Lynn.
Smartphone apps designed to slow spread of the coronavirus have experienced low usage rates in Europe, where virus cases are again rising in several countries. The tracing systems are designed to let people know if they were near someone who was later confirmed to have the virus. Some nations moved quickly to develop such apps. The apps are considered an important tool in helping defeat the coronavirus. One reason the new coronavirus spreads easily is because many infected individuals show few or no signs of sickness. If a person learns they had been near someone who got infected, they could immediately isolate or seek treatment. But few people in Europe have used the apps. Some countries there have discontinued them. Other nations have said low usage rates make the technology ineffective. On the high end, about one-third of the population uses the apps in Finland and Ireland. In Germany, about 22% of people use them. But in France, the usage rate is just 4%. In the beginning, health officials targeted about 60% of the population. That goal was based on an Oxford University study published in April. Research models in the study predicted the virus spread could be stopped if at least 60% of populations used the contact tracing apps. The study suggested that even with lower usage levels, the number of coronavirus cases and deaths could be reduced. Smaller countries in Northern Europe have been most successful at getting people to voluntarily use the apps. People living in those countries generally have higher levels of trust in the government. Those countries are also likely to have more people willing to accept new technologies. Finland's app quickly became one of Europe's most popular when it launched at the start of September. It received about 1 million downloads within the first 24 hours. Some Finnish users said they thought that getting the app was an important civic responsibility. France's app uses a centralized data storage system. Privacy activists have criticized that method. The app has a usage rate of just 4%. Officials in Norway were forced to halt that country's app because of privacy concerns over its use of phone location data. German officials admit that the country's tracing app has experienced technical issues and some users had difficulties using it. But they note that the system has also seen success. Health Minister Jens Spahn said the app was used to send 1.2 million coronavirus test results from laboratories to users during its first 100 days. He noted that the tracing of possible contacts is more effective the sooner it begins. I'm Brian Lynn.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Running is a popular form of exercise. It is something you can do just about anywhere. And the only equipment you need is good running shoes. Some runners compete in marathons. They can spend months training for one of these 42-kilometer-long events. So to be a marathoner, you need strength. You need endurance and stamina. These two words both mean the ability to do something difficult for a long time. Now, a sprint is a different kind of foot race. Sprinters run at full speed over a short distance. So they do not need endurance or stamina for a sprint, but they do need to run very fast. Sprinters need speed. For today's program, we add the word mentality to sprint and marathon. Sprinter mentality and marathon mentality describe two different ways to complete a project or solve a problem. First, let's talk about a marathon mentality. People with a marathon mentality are willing to work on a project or job for a really long time. Now, just like in the race, with a big project, you need to pace yourself. If you start too quickly and do too much, you may run out of energy. A marathon mentality means that you are in something for the long haul. You are not going to walk away or leave before the job is finished. Here, long haul means a long period of time or a great distance. For example, long-haul truckers drive their large vehicles over great distances. Okay, now let's talk about sprinters. If you have a sprinter's mentality, you attack a problem with short, fast bursts of energy. There is no need to pace yourself. There isn't time. A sprinter's mentality means you do not hold back. You do something with all the energy you have. You can do this because you know the project or problem will only last a short time. Please note, we use the term sprinter mentality or sprinter's mentality. However, when talking about marathons, we usually say marathon mentality, not marathoner mentality. Of course, foot races, both sprints and marathons, have an end. You know, a finish line. But learning English or other languages is more of a lifelong event. So you may need a sprinter's mentality to finish some tasks, but over the long haul, a marathon mentality may serve you best. Whichever it is, Just know that we, here at VOA Learning English, are cheering you on. And that's Words and Their Stories for this week. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The old Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson had split into two opposing groups. President John Quincy Adams led one of the groups. It called itself the National Republican Party. Andrew Jackson, a military hero and politician, led the other group. It called itself the Democratic Party. Each party had its own newspapers. In Washington, the Daily National Journal supported President Adams. The United States Telegraph supported General Jackson. The Telegraph published accusations by Democrats in Congress against the administration. The Journal, in turn, published a pamphlet that said Jackson had fought a man, chased him away like a dog, and then stolen his wife. Jackson denied these claims. Historians still do not know how much of this story is true, but the story had a great effect on Jackson for the rest of his life. Jackson met the young woman, Rachel, at her mother's home near Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel and her husband, Louis Robards, were living there at the time. They were having marriage problems. Robards argued with his wife about Jackson. He said she and Jackson seemed too close. Robards reportedly wanted to fight Jackson with his fists. Jackson said he would face Robards not in a fist fight, but in a gunfight if Robards wished to fight like a gentleman. Robards rejected the invitation to a duel, and nothing more happened between the two men. Robards and his wife settled their differences, but a short time later, they had another dispute, and Rachel left. Court records said she left with a man, Andrew Jackson. Rachel's family said she told Robards she wanted a divorce. They said he threatened her, telling her he would carry her away by force. So Rachel's family said she decided to flee. She decided to go with some traders to Natchez in the dangerous Mississippi Territory. By now, Rachel meant a great deal to Andrew Jackson. He had fallen in love with her. When the traders asked him to go with them to Natchez to protect them, he agreed. The group left for the territory early in 1791. For his part, Louis Robards began preparations for a divorce. He allowed Rachel's family to believe that he and Rachel were no longer married. But in fact, he did not complete the necessary legal action to make the divorce final. Jackson returned from Natchez after several months. His opponents later claimed that he had married Rachel while in Natchez. They said she was still another man's wife at the time. Opponents said the couple's relationship was both immoral and illegal. They said Jackson was an adulterer for having a relationship with a married woman. And they said Rachel was a bigamist for having two husbands. But Jackson said he believed Rachel and her first husband, Louis Robards, were divorced. He said he returned to Nashville to ask Rachel's mother for permission to marry her daughter, and that she agreed. Andrew and Rachel Jackson remained in Tennessee. The next 2 years were busy for Jackson. As a young lawyer, he worked hard and traveled far. Then in December 1793, Jackson said he discovered court papers showing that Louis Robards had only recently divorced Rachel. Jackson said he was shocked. As soon as possible, he and Rachel were married again, legally this time. Almost 10 years passed. Jackson became a judge and got involved in Tennessee politics. But the circumstances of his marriage remained an issue that led to arguments. For instance, a man once accused Jackson of cheating on a horse racing bet. Then the man called his wife a bigamist. Jackson killed the man in a duel. Later, in the 1828 presidential election, Jackson's opponents made Rachel's honor a campaign issue. Jackson could not duel everyone who questioned his wife's honor, so he asked a special committee of citizens to investigate his marriage and make a public report. Many people on the committee were his friends or supporters. The committee found that the Jacksons were not at fault for getting married before Rachel and her first husband were legally divorced. The pro-Jackson newspaper in Washington published the committee's report. Pro-Jackson papers also began to print vicious stories about President Adams and his wife. Anti-Jackson newspapers did not publish the committee's report. They continued to denounce the Jacksons' marriage. Historian Daniel Feller at the University of Tennessee is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He says the charges about Jackson's marriage made a good story for people to talk about. But, he says, other accusations were more serious. These were about Jackson's career.
The attacks that really hit home were about Jackson's unauthorized and perhaps directly against orders conquest of Florida in 1819, his sometimes savage disciplinary measures against his own troops, his declaring martial law in New Orleans and maintaining martial law in New Orleans and arresting people in New Orleans well after the War of 1812 was actually over.
All during the bitter election campaign, neither Jackson nor his opponent, President Adams, said anything about one very important issue, slavery. Adams did not want to lose what little support he had in the South and West by denouncing slavery. Jackson did not want to lose the support of some Republicans in the North by openly defending it. Adams's silence did not mean that he approved of slavery. Southerners were sure that he opposed it, and Jackson did not have to tell the South what he thought about slavery. He was a slave owner, and he had bought and sold slaves all his life. There was another important difference between the two men and their political parties. President Adams and the Republicans represented the interests of those who owned property. Many of the president's supporters felt that wealthy, property-owning citizens should control the government. Jackson and the Democrats represented the interests of the common people. They did not feel that the rich had more right to govern than the poor. The presidential election of 1828 was held on different days in the different states between October 31st and November 5th. Voters in the northern states supported John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson won the South. Historian Daniel Feller says
Southerners did not seem bothered by opponents' fears that Jackson was mentally unstable and believed he should have unlimited power.
They were much more compelled by the image of this great man of the people and also this great man on horseback, the hero of New Orleans.
Even President Adams recognized that Jackson was extremely well-liked.
John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary years before the election that in a popularity contest, in a political contest, no man could stand against the hero of New Orleans.
When the electoral votes were counted, Andrew Jackson received 178. President Adams received only 83. Rachel Jackson was proud of her husband, but she was not happy about the life she would have to lead as First Lady, and her health seemed to be suffering. For Mr. Jackson's sake, she said, I am glad. For my own part, I never wished it. Nevertheless, the couple prepared to move to Washington. There was little time for Rachel to rest. Then, just a few days before the Jacksons were to move, two doctors were called to the Jackson home. They found Rachel in great pain. She seemed to be having a heart attack. After a day or so, she appeared to be better. She was able to sit up and talk with friends, but her mind was still troubled about the years ahead in Washington. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, she said, than to dwell in that palace in Washington. She was referring to the presidential mansion, later known as the White House. In December of 1828, a few nights before Christmas, Rachel was sitting in a chair. Her husband had already gone to sleep. Suddenly, Rachel cried out and fell to the floor. The servants screamed. Jackson ran to the room, picked Rachel up, and carried her to the bed. But he could see that life had already left her. Witnesses said Jackson continued to sit next to her, holding his head in his hands. Rachel was buried 2 days later. 10,000 people went to the funeral. The Reverend William Hume spoke of Rachel Jackson's life. He talked of her kindness and humility, and he told how she had been upset about the personal accusations against her during the election campaign. Jackson believed those accusations were a cause of Rachel's death. His anger is expressed on the stone above Rachel's grave. One line of the inscription says, "A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound, but could not dishonor." At that time, Andrew Jackson was 61 years old. He was a tall, thin man. His long face was wrinkled. Most portraits of him show a great mass of messy hair pushed back from his high forehead. Jackson's health had never really been good. He carried in his body two bullets from duels fought years before. But he was a tough man, with a spirit strong enough to keep moving, even when he was grieving. He left for Washington in January 1829. A huge crowd was gathering there to meet him. They would create one of the wildest inaugural celebrations in American history. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. We hope you enjoyed it. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.